Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Good morning, Mike. Last time where we left off, we were talking about habits and practice and desire. And so I think where they all can start to come together is when we talk through spiritual disciplines a little bit, what it looks like to maybe practice those, what your experience and background is. So why don't we start there? How does that sound?
Okay. That would be great.
Wonderful. So give us, you know, for those not familiar, just give us an introduction to spiritual backgrounds and a little bit of how you came to discover them or practice them yourself.
Sure. So I came to faith in 1873. No. I came to faith in my freshman year in college, which was 1973, actually. But it wasn't until 1995, that's 22 years later, that a friend of mine recommended I take a course under Dallas Willard. It was part of my doctoral studies. And we read The Spirit of the Disciplines. And that began to take me down this wonderful rabbit hole. So the title sometimes loses people. I think if Simon Sinek had given his Start With Why before Willard's book, the book might have been titled The Disciplines, Start With Why. Because most of the books that I'm familiar with or aware of on the spiritual disciplines start with how and what. And hence, I can probably count on one hand, maybe two, the number of people who have a habit of practicing the spiritual disciplines, could even list them, and yet many, many, many people have read about them. But I think the books they read are how and what, and their books a lot like how to eat well. Then you go back to eating the way you normally eat. So that was my introduction with Dallas Willard, 1995, The Spirit of the Disciplines.
Yeah, that's a book you recommended back a little while ago. And yeah, I want to say maybe 3/4 of the book is really about the why, really about mm-hmm. like what is the spirit behind the disciplines? Why do we do this? And the last, I don't know, third or quarter of it is really a lot of examples of disciplines.
Yes, and that's why on a sidebar, I hadn't thought about this until I knew we were going to talk about this, but that's why most of my friends, they say, I had trouble getting through the book. And it's because in a left brain world, the left brain is biased towards how and what. And so if you're a left brain person, you're going to go, yeah, I didn't understand it. Whereas there are other books that get right into, here's how you practice this. Here's how you practice this. So this problem is compounded by the Enlightenment, which in its emphasis on language and words, which are more the domain of the left hemisphere over 500 years, has created a society that biases the left brain. Hence, Dr. Willard's book, many people, I've gotten a lot out of it, but a whole lot more tell me, oh, I just had trouble getting through it. Not practical.
Yeah, I mean, I I understand where they're coming from, considering I was part of the Enlightenment in the last 500 years. But
is that old?
but it's definitely definitely worth a read. I enjoyed it myself. Yeah. And so, aside from the how and what, then let's talk through some of the why. What are some of the reasons behind spiritual disciplines?
Yes, I would. So I would do it in this regard. I'd ask, first of all, we're created in the image of God, who has no body. God is spirit. So why do we have a body?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm
So
hoping you have the answer.
The next one. We have no answer for that one. But first of all, you have to back it all the way out to let us make them in our image. So we are in the image of God in multifaceted ways, but he has no body. Father, Son, Spirit. In fact, we know the second person of the Godhead, Jesus, took on human flesh to come to the earth. So what is going on with this heavens and earth that he creates us? So I think, as we've shared earlier, my bias is that the gospel is much, much more than just simply God loves us, we are sinners, Jesus came, died on the cross for us. That's a gospel that doesn't start till Genesis 3 and pretty much concludes when you get to heaven. I happen to think if that's true, then there's no good news before Genesis 3. I happen to think the good news starts before creation, when Father, Son, Spirit determine and seek to expand the circle of love. You cannot expand the circle of love by creating another God, but you can create beings in the image of God. So God decides to wed his love with humanity. So we are made to be the bride of Christ. Now, the best way to experience this mind-blowing, indescribably delicious union is through your body, a physical body with sensation, appetites, habits, desires. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Western mechanized rationalistic world, we reduce that down to something very ethereal. But as a matter of fact, I think that's why we have a body. It is to actually taste, to experience God. And so that's why there are faith traditions in the past that are still around today that tell us that the gospel is best told in our physical body. Hence, that's why we have a body. So if you start there, and we had never fallen, guess what? We wouldn't need spiritual disciplines.
Meaning that we'd be naturally just doing those things.
Yeah, that's right. Our every inclination, just as we read that our Father is in the heavens, Psalm 115:3, heavens, plural, that means he inhabits the very space that, if you're a listener right now, he inhabits all the space in every corpuscle of your body and all the space that you can reach all around with your hands and feet. He inhabits all that. He saturates all that. But it goes on to say, our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases. Then it says we're made in his image. So in Psalm 37:4, Augustine translated it this way: love God, do what you want to do, because God does what he wants to do. In a fallen world, that requires bodily disciplines, because we now know from neuroimaging, anywhere from 95 to 90% of what you do is non-conscious. It's habit. If you don't have rightly ordered loves, you don't have rightly ordered habits. If you don't have rightly ordered habits, you're not going to become a godly person. So I think when you start with that kind of why, I equate it to this, that it'd be like if God were to show up tomorrow morning and say to you, Pat, I want you to win the Marine Corps Marathon this coming weekend. you would say?
I'm sorry to disappoint.
No, he says, no, I want you to be filled with the Spirit and really pray hard. And you would say?
Okay, I must trust God.
Oh, there you go. So how likely do you think that, how likely, well, you can see the absurdity, is the absurdity is it is such an over-spiritualized view because you go, well, my body's not trained. Now, yes, if you are the Virgin Pat, second rendition of the Virgin Mary, how can this be? Yes. I'm one way to look at it is the Spirit could overcome you, waft your body through every other runner. And of course, you'd immediately then be investigated because they would say, this guy has no training. How can he do this? I doubt that God's into that kind of spectacular sign and wonder because that would say that he is going to suspend the laws of the universe for you to win that. It's an absurd example, but it bears out that it's like someone who overeats and then asks God to suspend the laws of the universe and have their heart not need a stint one day when they're older. And so when you start with why, even in running a race, you'd end up with, you have to live within the laws of the universe that God made. He can certainly suspend them if he wants to. But you get to be a pretty flabby Christian if you go around your whole life saying, I don't want to reap what I've sown, Lord. Suspend the laws of the universe for these 6,900 habits I have so that I can be a godly person.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I think that actually spreads or puts some light on what prayer is as a discipline. And I think it's confusing mm-hmm. sometimes to I hear people talk about a lot. I was even reading an article, I don't know, 6 months, a year ago, and it was about this profound insight to why this girl who was raised in the church gave up prayer and how her life's never been the same because she gave up prayer. And as I was reading it, it was clear to me that this wasn't prayer as a discipline. This was prayer as a calling card for God of God, can you do this? And well, if I, if I say these things, is God really listening? All of those elements that I think you sort of avoid those when you start to view prayer as a discipline.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess what's your perspective then on some of these other disciplines, or maybe let's just name a few. And I ask because the story that came up to mind for me was sitting in a group and we were talking about, you know, how do we encourage one another to pursue our faith more? And sort of what was not necessarily said is, okay, that means everyone here said they're struggling with prayer, and everyone here said they're struggling with reading their Bible. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I said, it may be helpful to remember there are other disciplines outside of prayer and scripture study.
Mm-hmm.
A lot
yes.
of people don't realize that. So I don't know. What are some of those other disciplines?
Yes, and this is good question. Well, first of all, I was going to mention one other thing. When you start with why, and then you recognize that we're in a fallen world, includes our habits, therefore, and our bodies. Another why, so the why in creation is because to actually taste and see that the Lord is good, and actually feel in our body foreshadowings of what it means to be united with him. But in fall, those habits now, I look at it this way. Willard doesn't put it this way, but I came away from his course recognizing every appetite you have right now, your body is either an ally or an enemy at this very moment. It's not neutral. Your body, not so much your brain, your body at this moment is either your enemy or your ally in becoming, and well, if you want to put it, pursuing your faith, but it's not neutral. When you start there, Then there are two generally accepted categories of disciplines: disciplines of abstinence and disciplines of engagement. Disciplines of abstinence are what I call pulling the plug on the things that give you juice. Disciplines of engagement are replugging in to better sockets. So disciplines of abstinence, the first ones are the most fundamental, and that is silence and then solitude. Any idea why?
Well, we've talked about that in a couple conversations so far, and I think part of that is to get away from the noise. It's hard to hear if you're crowded with noise.
Yes, very good. And the other side of the coin is why? What is the benefit not only to pull away from noise, but silence? What is the benefit of you being silent?
Learning that it's not important for me to talk all the time.
Bingo! That's it.
Yeah.
Then God said in Genesis, God doesn't hit CrossFit for a year, get buffed up, and then start creating. He speaks. And we are made in his image, so we literally further create, or order rather, reality by what we say. Jesus did warn us. He said, Mike, every careless word you say, you will give an account of in the final judgment. Why? Well, because words that don't reflect reality, we read in Ephesians, grieve the Spirit of God. They grieve God. He goes, oh, no, no. That's why Jesus said at one point, if you call someone a moron, you're guilty of the flames of hell. I mean, this is serious stuff. You don't call beings made in the image of God idiots and morons. Of course, they may be fallen, they may be evil, they might be, but they're not, you don't go to that kind of slanderous language. So silence, the first time I did it, it blew my mind how empty silence felt. And it was just the beginning of understanding or recognizing how much I fill empty space with words, with no cognizance of, you will give an account of these words, Mike. There's even the notion in the Old Testament that when we come to worship, therefore let your words be few.
So Mike, I'm just gonna let you do the rest of the talking for this conversation.
Now, I'm about to say the same to you, Pat.
Well,
okay, listener alert. The rest of the podcast is very quiet.
We're gonna practice
silence. We're giving you some space here.
Well,
we'll put some music on in the background.
when you first practice silence. So what? I don't know. What's an example of that? Is that just sitting in a chair in the corner? Like, what do you recommend if I'm going to try silence for the first time? What do you recommend?
First, you have to clear out the space. So you, if necessary, if your wife doesn't go off to work, or your spouse, rather, you would say, hey, I'm starting some practices. This first one is going to be for, and again, experiment. Don't load yourself up and then fail and go, well, that's miserable. It might be an hour, but just get permission from anyone who might intersect that this is, here's a practice, here's why you're doing it, and you're just trying to pull the plugs. And then get away from background noise if you can. You just reminded me, it's funny, when you begin to practice silence, one of the first things you notice is how much, even though I love music, it's playing everywhere all the time in the background. It's like, if you ever get to complete silence, and that might mean you go out for a walk in the woods, and but you even stop the rustling of the leaves crunching beneath your feet, you sit. Some people get, I had a friend once tell me, he went up to Montana for 3 days, and he said, but after day one, he was stir crazy. That's what I mean by disciplines of abstinence are, my friend had no idea how many outlets he had plugged into to keep him juiced up and going that were noise, just simply noise. So that's the discipline of silence. You clear out the space. You stipulate how long it's going to be. Don't do more than you realistically can at first. And I will guarantee you this, Pat. Done well with the second one that we're about to talk about, solitude, God will sneak up behind you in ways that you have non-consciously closed yourself off to because we're so busy talking and filling up our lives while we're not even aware of our empty spaces. They just feel empty and we fill them up. So silence is when I first began to experience the Lord saying, I want to talk to you about this. And I remember my first thought was like, what? I didn't even see it coming. I envisioned it came walking a path behind me that I didn't even know existed.
Oh, wow.
And so I want to talk to you about this.
And when you are practicing this, are you still doing other things? Are you sitting and
no.
intentionally doing nothing?
No, doing nothing. Well, you know what I'm consciously doing? That's where I came up with, I didn't come up with a picture. I don't come up with pictures. They come to me. Is I literally start walking around the room and unplugging. So I might be, I got a song playing in my head. I got YouTube going in my head. And I go over it, pull it. And within 10 seconds, something else is pull it. Drone. Pull it.
Well, one thing Dallas Willard mentions in his book that stuck with me for it was very impactful, was the part where he talks about the why, of course, but he mentions what would Jesus do? And that idea that we often think, oh, you know, what's the right thing to do? And in this situation, and so the situation comes up and then we find ourselves reflecting, why didn't I do what I was supposed to do? Yeah. And he kind of talks to that and says, what we don't highlight or emphasize enough is the amount of time Jesus went off and had times of spiritual disciplines, of silence, of solitude. You see that throughout the New Testament pretty frequently, where Jesus goes off and spends time in prayer. And his argument was that, yes, Jesus was God on earth, and so he had this ability to do what was right, sure, but he also invested time in practicing.
Yeah,
even God in human form was practicing.
Right.
And so when the situation came where he had to pick and do what was right, he was able to, in part, and Willard argues in large part, because he had been practicing these disciplines. And so our journey to practice the why is so that we can align ourselves in the situation when it comes up, we can be already aligned.
That's brilliant. Exactly right.
So you mentioned solitude. What's different between that and silence?
Solitude is getting away from it. It's so I can practice, for example, silence. I do it now a lot when I drive. For some reason, the more you practice silence, I can't think of the last time I turned down any music or anything in the car. I'm not opposed to that, but it's pretty quiet when I'm driving around. Solitude is not driving around. It really is getting, it could be, I work from home. Kathy's reading text, so she leaves at 8 in the morning. It could be sitting in our, one of our alcoves, and it's just me and the Lord, solitude. Some people, again, find you have to do this for more than 5 minutes, but solitude is different in that, as you well said, silence is how much we fill up what we perceive as empty space with words or noise, the spirit word. So it doesn't have to be words. It can be TV, internet, YouTube, I mean, just blah, 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 blah. Solitude, the benefit, as Willard points out, first of all, just give that space for the Lord to walk up a path you're not familiar with and say, yeah, you got a problem with this, Mike. Second, solitude is when you re-engage the wider world. As I think he says something to this effect, you find out that you discover everybody got along fine without you. The world didn't slow down. It didn't spin off its axis. So solitude helps us see that we are not essential to the equation. We're privileged to partner with God, but God doesn't need us.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, talk about curbing pride. Spend some time in solitude.
That's a good point, Pat. You're right. It's I hadn't thought of that, but I think you're exactly right. It's, you know, many, many before us consider pride the chief vice. And you probably can take it back to Lucifer. I will ascend. I will. I will. So you're right. I think that solitude is helps you come back and go, huh. Things motoring on. It wasn't a headline in Drudge Report. Mike Metzger takes weekend off in solitude. World slows down.
So we got silence and solitude. What are some of the? What are some of the other ones that come to mind for you?
Well, I'm just stealing from Willard's book. Maybe we'll jack his sales up a bit. But the next one is fasting. And this was, when I practice it well, it's because I've been practicing silence and solitude. When I don't practice it well, or frankly don't even practice it, it's when I'm not practicing silence and solitude. Let's be clear also real quickly, the reason they're called disciplines is you want to get to a place where they're not disciplines, they're non-conscious habits. But until they're at that place, they're discipline. And discipline is the Greek word where we get our word gymnasium. And I've been told, that's why 1 Timothy 4:7, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. You really want to pursue your faith? You got to discipline yourself. You got to get in a gym, and as you know, even back in the Olympics, it was you stripped down so you had no hindrances. Some of the wrestling, Greco-Roman, they were naked. It wasn't erotic. It was just simply This requires every single corpuscle. You exercise till you're exhausted. And that's the idea. You exercise till your guts are pooped out if you want to become godly. Willard says as well in another book, grace is only opposed to earning. It's not opposed to effort. And I think a lot of us have this idea. Grace means no effort. It's all God. No, not true. So fasting is the next one. And here's the first thing you discover with fasting is how often I stuff my face to feel better about life.
Yep.
So last night, we've had a little water damage in our house, and it's taken up a cleanup. And so last night we got home, I said, oh, man, I'm just so tired. And, you know, a little depressed, but not quite depressed. I shouldn't minimize that, but a little discouraged. So I said, I'm getting me a big bowl of ice cream. Yeah, oh, that worked. But when you fast, a couple things happen that are fascinating. So I never forgot the first time I was fasting. It's a long time ago. And I'm pumping gas. And I'm looking around at the service station, you know, and they're a little mini grocery store. And I'm looking at the signage. I'm looking at even at the gas pump advertising this and that. And I go, my God, food is everywhere in our society. Everywhere. And I just never really noticed that before. And the second thing is, you do see how, you know, it might be 12 noon, you're like, man, time for lunch. You don't even ask your body, well, are you hungry? No, it's time for lunch. Oh. Well, you know, until the industrial revolution, they averaged 2 meals a day. Or some people, you know, kind of nibbled through the day. The idea of 3 squares is relatively recent in history. Then the last thing, Pat, that maybe this would encourage people to come to fasting differently, and that wouldn't come until I practice silence and solitude, because otherwise it won't be effective, is how much it cleanses your palate. And I mean this. Now, I'm not advocating any particular form. Kathy, my wife, will tell you, I generally do a 3-day fast. I find the 1 day is too jarring and minimal in its effect. A 3-day, you literally slip into this slipstream. You have greater mental acuity, and that's because your body, your blood is more flowing in and out of your brain than in your gut trying to get that ice cream worked into your system in some way. I have more energy. It's really wonderful. You have this, and I have more mental acuity. And I think God's kind of cleanses your system. So what happens is when you come off a fast, this is critical. You have to come off carefully. You don't load it up. You say, oh, good, the fast is over. I'm giving me a big bowl of ice cream. But instead, you come off with good vegetables, something light. And I find my appetite for sweets has been really cut. I don't want sweets. I find I had an apple, and I just remember thinking, oh, this is so good. Your palate is heightened, because a lot of what we eat dulls our palate, fried foods and stuff like that. So give yourself a break, because I'm having a flashback all of a sudden. I did try to practice fasting once in college. This is way back in the 70s, 20 years before I met Dr. Willard. And there were a bunch of us, and we said, hey, we gotta fast. And, oh, okay, I'll fast. And I fasted that day. I was a senior in college. But I remember I made it till midnight and I woke up and I ran to our kitchen and grabbed a bunch of Oreos and went back under the covers and just stuffed my face with Oreos. I made it to the fast. I made it to. We did say a day.
That's great. You know, I was listening to another podcast at one point, and they were talking about intermittent fasting. And one of the things the guy said, which I thought was pretty cool, was he said, you know, one thing I've gained from just doing this intermittent fasting is when I'm sitting there and I'm hungry, it's just not that big of a deal anymore. You know, it doesn't make me hangry. And B, if the example he was using was he was on a plane and he was starting to get hungry, and he was like, you know, I could indulge in some airline food right now, or I could wait a couple more hours and have a really good meal later.
Yep.
And I immediately thought, man, like, yeah, the intermittent fasting, I think, is very different than what we look at as traditional, you know, spiritual fasting. And I think there's definitely an emphasis on if you do a day fast, a 3 day fast, I definitely recommend that. But even something as subtle as intermittent fasting, where you, for those unfamiliar, you're shrinking the time that you actually eat. So you would only eat between, you know, 12 and 8 p.m. and that's it, no food outside of that window. But even that gives you the practice, the discipline to grow in these areas that I do. I think God looks down and goes, yeah, that's you're getting it. You're learning how I designed you, how you ought to be.
Hmm. That's really good. That's really good. I couldn't have said it better.
Well, I take a particular interest in the word hangry. I hear it all the time, and I hear it from believers, and I get it. I definitely get it. But to your point, I think it is realistic to say that we ought not to be emotionally changed to that extent when we don't get the food that we want in the 4 hour window that most Americans will go without food before they get hungry, right?
Yeah.
There's something to be said about that.
That's good, Pat. I agree. And which you just reminded me of, another benefit was in fasting. So in my best years, it'd be every quarter, I have a 3 day fast. First of all, you have to be aware there are going to be a lot of people that will be uncomfortable, and you have to assure them it's okay. So someone would say, I might be out for lunch, and they say, what are you going to order? I said, well, I'm just going to have a glass of water. And was everything okay? Yeah, let's not make a big deal. I'm on fast, it's okay. You sure you don't want to eat something? That sort of thing. They mean well, but
right.
You can find a way to get clearance on that. The second thing is when you fast, when you come back off a fast, you eat slower, and I don't know how fast they ate. We're using fast, how rapidly they ate. I remember once with someone, you just start eating slower, and I wasn't a third of the way through my meal, and this plate was clean. And I didn't say anything, but I just wanted to go, wow. And he kind of gulped down his wine. So I'm not pointing fingers. It was more, I'm the same way. I would never have thought about it. But we do know God has given the human race, it appears, this 20-minute, some kind of mechanism in your brain that at 20 minutes it signals when you're full. So if you wolf down a meal in 10, 15 minutes, you're likely going to eat more than you actually need because you haven't hit that window where your brain would say, that's all we need. Don't eat anymore. But yet eat slowly. You give a chance for your body to send the signals to your brain. That's all we need. So fast food presents a problem because of how rapidly in the Western world we now eat. I can't speak to any other society, but we eat too rapidly.
Yeah, so I'm curious from your perspective, Do you view a the rec you recommended a 3 day? That was what you said was really valuable for you.
Well, I built to that. Yeah, I found that 1 day was pretty easy, but it felt like a ka-chunk, ka-chunk. Mm-hmm. Versus you really do feel you hit this jet stream on your second day.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say my recommendation would be, I love the phrase, practice doesn't make perfect, perfect practice makes perfect. And so if fasting is something you've never done, get your feet wet. We live in a world where even fasting a meal or two can make a difference. But I think it does. It starts to foster a desire for something that's a little right. bit longer. But don't hesitate. And what we're talking about here is not just avoiding food. An example that I recommended to a friend of mine that was kind of going through this exercise with me, and this at a time was when we were taking a couple weeks, and every Friday we were fasting the first two meals of the day, right? And so we use that as a time to not just avoid food, but really sit and allow. And also, I'm not saying replace fasting with prayer. So often the thing I've heard too is when you're fasting, that means that when you're supposed to be eating, you should be praying. Mm-hmm. And Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you need to use prayer. I don't think that's the only way to enhance or to do fasting as a discipline. Fasting as a discipline is a discipline in and of itself. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So as a matter of fact, I urge people to get your hands dirty on something. So when you're fasting, paint, do yard work, go for a run. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And the piece that I found was really valuable for me was during lunchtime. I was at the office, so I would work through lunch, and instead of just being kind of ignoring my hunger, I would actually sit and sort of embrace that hunger a little bit, and first recognize that there are many in the world that mm-hmm. feel this all the time. And yeah. I am very fortunate that I don't have to, particularly here in the West. I mean, it's incredible. That by itself fueled so much gratitude for me over that season of fasting. Just that alone, on top of then recognizing that, man, this hunger is sort of how, A, I'm privileged not to feel, but B, I kind of should feel this way, right? In light of the fall and in the sinful state of man, I should be hungry. I should be in this depraved, quote unquote, state, but I'm not. And I'm not most of my life. And that is incredible grace. And so even in those, that period where it was two meals a day, I mean, it was very profound in sort of resetting myself, like you talked about, to correctly view the world, I think as God intended for me to view it, just a glimpse of it at least.
Exactly right. It's that's why fasting is another pulling the plug discipline where, yeah, when I used to travel a lot in terms of if I was driving even, I would, it wasn't until I did fasting that I began to realize how much that these 7-Elevens, wherever, those things called combos, those little pretzels with cheese in them.
Delicious.
A bag of combos and a Diet Dr. Pepper, and man, all the world was A-okay. And I'm just going, it's not totally fasting. I was pumping gas. I was in Carolina. And I go, oh, man, that's what gives me, like, God loves me and everything's cool. And I'm not even that hungry. I'm just kind of like, I just may be a little anxious about some things. And so this is going to, we do know that, you well know, I mean, food releases certain chemicals in the brain to give you a sense of well-being. And so to your point, you're right. Practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes habit. Mm. So I don't know if there's any such thing as, I don't believe you can practice perfectly. So there's no perfect practice. Instead, practice makes habit. So good practices make good habits. And 95% of our behaviors, even what we think, are just habitual. They're just habits. That's the way God made us, because you can't consciously think everything you're doing and be consciously on top of every appetite in your body and what your body's doing. Hence, your body will betray you or will benefit you. It's your enemy or it's your ally. And you cannot be a godly person if your body is not your ally. And it will not be your ally if it has not been whipped into shape. Just as I know you well enough, Pat, to know you can't just pray yourself to benching whatever massive amount of weight you bench. You had to whip your body into shape.
That's right. Those 25 pounds can't lift themselves, you know?
Yeah, there's a little false humility for you.
Yeah, you said it well, Mike. What we're talking about is don't fast for the sake of fasting.
It's not weight loss.
Right. Yes.
People come back off the fast, like I did in my first one, with an explosion of Oreo cookies.
Yes. Fast in pursuit of good habits. To develop, to practice good habits.
Habit is by definition non-conscious. So if someone talks a lot, I've probably been here too, but I know a number of people. Kathy and I come away and say, well, actually we were at dinner and she said, you know, that guy talked 95% of the time. He loves Jesus, wonderful guy, but I don't think he's aware of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So meditation came to mind for me, and I'm curious. I've heard a number of different kind of interpretations of that. It's more of a hip thing these days. But what is your view on the spirit of meditation? So why do we do it? And then really, like, what does that actually look like in comparison to silence, solitude, and some of the other disciplines?
It probably is a discipline. I've not read about it as a discipline, but it is a practice, and I get it, and it is beneficial. It does come out of, a lot of people think it comes out of the East, even though it does. It actually has origins in the Christian faith as well, because the early faith was Asian, African, and European. And so the early church was also Eastern in many ways. And one would be a better understanding of meditation. Meditation, Pat, basically comes out of the notion that God is, and so all of life is a uncovering or discovering from receiving from Him. So freely you give, because freely you've received, freely give. Or another way to put it, we love because He first loved us. So the degree to which you can love someone is the degree to which you have actually received and experienced God's love. Now that includes, therefore, the idea of receptivity, which is a kissing cousin to meditation, to silence, solitude. But it is the idea reflected that as the bride of Christ, for example, why we come to the communion table, the Eucharist, and our hands are supposed to be palms up, folded over one another, and spread open as a bride opens her body to her husband. It's the idea that we receive, and then we're to ponder these. So remember when Mary was told that she was going to have a baby as a virgin, and so she pondered these things. But ponder is meditation. It is to chew on them. Not to, quote, figure it out, but rather to say, Lord, how can this be? That's meditation. Lord, how can this be? And you listen. The meditation is listening. So it is very similar to silence and solitude. And that way, we are not limiting God in this regard. Most of us, me included, we come every day to God and life and what have you with millions of non-conscious assumptions about how life is supposed to work out. Some may be right, some may be wrong. Meditation is a way for God to peel you open and go, that one's wrong. That's where you don't trust me. That's where you don't know me. This is where. So it fits with silence and solitude and fasting. That's probably the best, because I think of disciplines as abstinence and engagement. The ones of engagement, reality, Thanksgiving, things like that. It's coming to the world different because you have pulled the plug on everything else. Meditation might be a good crossover between the two, but it still fits very closely with the pulling the plug disciplines, because meditation in the same way says stop, unplug.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's good. And I, one of the things I really liked about Willard's book is he starts to go through a bunch of the disciplines in the end. And he mentioned some that I had never thought about as disciplines. Celebration was an example. And so what a friend of mine, when we were doing this kind of 6 week or so exercise, we would fast the first two meals. And then that last meal was intended to be celebration. And so it was is a mindful partaking and eating in a way that I just hadn't thought about celebrating before. And so I thought that was cool and also profound in this realization that there are some disciplines that I'm already doing and I may not be mindfully practicing them. And so we're not saying start to do random things that you've never done before. Yeah, some of those are good, but also it's really good to be mindful of what am I already doing that I could be doing better.
That's right. It's yesterday I was reading in the Wall Street Journal a little article on Alzheimer's, and it was a story about a 74-year-old woman who had begun to suffer some memory loss. And 2 years ago, and she began to hit the gym. She also began to eat better, so she said, I'm discovering I have biceps. Here's a 74-year-old woman. So that's what I mean by, you know, you said, well, you begin to notice some things. And she goes, I'm discovering I have biceps.
Yes, yeah.
And she slimmed down and she finds, I can have total recall now of what happened yesterday. Now she says, it's not perfect, but it's far better. And so she's put herself in a discipline. You can even see how it's changing her mind and it's putting her in touch with things that she didn't know that much about before. Like I can grow biceps.
Yeah. Yeah. And that reminds me, the end pursuit of all of this, like we've talked about in past conversations, we are to enjoy and desire our Heavenly Father. That is what we're here to do. And we do many things throughout our day that we do not even think about. Where our desires are pointing. And so we do these things not just to get biceps, or like Mike said earlier, we do these things not just to lose weight. We don't fast to lose weight, but we do understand there is a way in which I walk through my life that I should desire deeper heavenly things. And spiritual disciplines are a way to help begin correct and sort of shape that path. So that as I get up and as I eat and as I celebrate, as I sit in silence, instead of needing to fill that with my phone, I can actually just enjoy the Lord in those moments.
That's right, Pat. I desire Kathy, my wife, to desire me as much as I desire her. Truth be told, because we do some fair amount of marital counseling, that's rarely the case in most marriages today. But I think God desires a bride who desires him as much as he desires her. That's why Paul wrote, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. He wants a godly bride. Paul, that wrote it this way, he said, I betrothed you to the Corinthian church. I betrothed you, married you to Christ. Not going to get married, not engaged you. I married you because at the cross we were betrothed to Christ. You have to read Jeremiah 31 to understand that. So that when we come to Christ, see someone come to faith, as Paul did with the Corinthian church, he wrote, I betrothed you to Christ with the aim that I might present you at this wedding ceremony in the future as a pure virgin. That's who Jesus wants to have come to the wedding ceremony. And as you know, in Judaism at that time, and even in scripture, in the early church, we are betrothed. That means we are married. Then we prepare. And then there is a wedding ceremony in the wedding bed. And about a year span between the two. Hence, Mary is betrothed to Joseph. Joseph is called the husband of Mary. Joseph is probably off preparing a place. And that's why he's shocked when he finds that his wife is pregnant. So I think Jesus just wants to come with his entourage to the wedding ceremony and have a bride who is panting and prepared and pure to be with him, desires him as much as he desires her. And that will require aligning our body to become our ally in this, not our enemy.
Well said. Well said.
And that's today's podcast. Now let's go get some donuts.
Yes. Well, yeah, we've talked a lot about Spirit of the Disciplines by Dallas Willard. Definitely recommend that book. Like Mike said, it may take a little bit to get through. The first good chunk is the why, but I think the why is worth it. There are other books on spiritual disciplines. They don't all kind of frame them in terms of abstinence and engagement. But yeah, if you're interested in the disciplines, I definitely recommend really anything. Just get started somewhere and pull those threads until you find something that is deepening your desire for the heavenly things.